giving our second talk today. The title is On Charge Black Holes in ABS Space. And Moshi's visiting us here at PI for May.
Okay, so first of all, thanks to the local authority for inviting me for such a long time. I'm feeling very fun here. Secondly, I have to apologize for my voice because I'm fighting a cold, so it's going to be slightly more nasal than usual. Okay, so the title is On Charge Black Hole in ABS Space. And this is work with Dom Brescher, who is our postdoc, and Jillian He, who is my student, he's here. And some part of it were done in collaboration with Paul Chapman from Dura. Okay, so let me outline the talk. Okay, so I'll start with motivation. This works. Okay, so I'll start with motivation. Some of it is motivation for work that was already done. Some of it is motivation for work that we intend to do. So there's going to be some unfulfilled promises there. Then I'm going to just review the mechanics, the basics of charged black holes in isotopic ABS spaces, their perturbation, which are the most interesting parts, at least the largest part of the motivation. Part of the perturbation is the fact that the inner horizon is effectively unstable. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about the perturbed solution, radius solution, a little bit about mass inflation, which I won't have too much to talk about later. Okay. So the point of this is that while embedding this structure in ABS-5, one can use the ABS-AFT to ask questions that are traditionally gravitational within this new context of the boundary AFT. And recently there's been a lot of interest in probing specifically thermal space-times, or more specifically space-time that have two boundary components, by these two-sided correlators I'm going to define and talk about. Those are somewhat subtle observables, but they're sensitive to features of the geometries that are usually not probed by the usual observables of ABS-AFT. So they're interesting. We're going to perform this calculation in the unperturbed Russell-Nostrom case, just to see how to do that, what are the features, and how are the features compared to the uncharged case. So in the Schwarzschild case, this project has been done. There are many subtleties there. There are a few features. And one of the points of this section is going to be that a lot of those features are not generic. That the situation is actually simpler and not as subtle in the more generic case. I'm going to talk about that later. Then I'm going to start talking about perturbation, and again, I won't go to the most general or most interesting perturbations. So first of all, there is a class of perturbations that allow us to what I'm going to call scanning behind the horizon. I'm going to be more precise during the talk. And we're going to look at the dependence of the observables that we calculate on this certain class of perturbations. And in conclusion, I'm going to continue the motivation about a more general set of perturbation, so-called the cross-law perturbations that leads to this phenomenon of mass inflation. You can interrupt me anytime as usual with questions. Okay, so let me briefly talk about motivations. I'm sure that most of you are motivated, so I'll be very brief here. Okay, so basically the main motivation here is the so-called singularity resolution. Many classical problems of semi-classical GR, one needs to go a little bit further, and string theory is supposed to be a theory of quantum gravity, among other things. So it would be nice to ask those questions within this framework. So this usually goes under the singularity resolution. One sharp set of questions is, what I wrote, can one unambiguously calculate scattering in cases where the classical GR breaks down? Okay. So the answer to that is yes, for time-like singularities, for a certain set of time-like singularities, they're relatively well understood. For time-like singularities, the two types of, you can classify the way they're resolved into two types. They can be resolved by string effects, alpha prime effects, or they can be resolved by non-perturbative string theory. But space-like singularities are more difficult, they're also more interesting. So for example, cosmological singularities, or black hole singularities. And what we attempt to do here is look at null singularities, which may or may not be intermediates here. Okay, such null singularities appear when you collide plane wave, or in this phenomenon of mass inflection that I'm going to talk about. The hope is that somehow this is easy. Okay. Now, it would be very nice to have a negative singularity to look at, that would be the easiest. But in this process, especially when you look at the whole, the singularities tend to hide behind the horizon, and we will have to look at observables that see behind horizons in some sense. This has interest in its own right, and so we'll have to talk about things like horizon complementarity. In this particular short context, this has to do with analyticity in some sense. Okay. And also, as I said before, the time-like singularities are resolved by either perturbative string theory effects or non-perturbative string theory effects. There is a feeling in the community that generically, the perturbative string theory is not going to resolve those space-like singularities. I'm not sure that this is always true, but this motivates you to look at some non-perturbative framework. In particular, ADS-EFT is the most developed calculational tool we have.
Question?
Yeah.
When you say a string theory resolves a time-like singularity, is that, what about, for example, negative mesh structure?
Oh, no, you solve some, not all of them. You don't want to solve them. Okay, so a little bit detail about which object I'm talking about, which are black hole in ADS. So this has the metric ansatz, which is a more general gravity metric solution, characterized by this one function f of r. R is a relative coordinate, and because it's a third black hole, there is another Maxwell field. This is the potential. Okay. So A is a Maxwell field. Now, if we embed that in ADS 5+S5, then this Maxwell field comes from one of the isometries of the S5. So the charge is really a rotation in the S5 direction. But you can talk about the five-dimensional context in which this is just a gauge field you have. And this phi, this large phi here, is some point.
This is at ADS 1 charge.
There is only one charge, so...
Yeah, but is this a diagonal? I think this is the metric I forgot. It is a metric. So in principle, I can have a U1 cube charge, right?
It's just Einstein Maxwell.
Right.
Einstein Maxwell, we said diagonal. Okay, Einstein Maxwell diagonal. Yes, okay, thanks. Sorry? No, so it's an alpha if you want, but then it's a scalar as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, this is the answer Maxwell's theory. Okay, and this function takes a very similar form to the rational symbolic hole in five dimensional asymptotic set space. It's R squared here. And it's the sign that you have asymptotically ADS. Okay, and M is the mass parameter to the charge, and I set the ADS radius to be 1. Okay. Now this space-time is horizons. The horizon is where this function vanishes. So you look at roots of this effectively cubic in R. Now, as usual, absence of negative singularity enforces some conditions on your parameters. You want that the outer horizon is really outer, is outside of the inner horizon. So So that enforces some inequality. It tells us that for fixed mass, the charge is bounded from the glass. Okay. Now, there's some peculiar thing here. For example, the fact that the extremal solution is non-zero temperature, and the fact that the supersymmetric solutions are negatively singular. So there is not very important for our discussion. Now, the field theory dual was investigated in a series of papers. I should say we followed the notation of this paper of Champlin and Duran, Johnson, and Myers. So one thing that one can do is the field theory is working in the grand canonical ensemble. So you fix the temperature, you fix the chemical potential that is conjugate to this particular charge. The fixed temperature is the Hawking temperature of the black hole. And the chemical potential in this ensemble is this constant phi, the Schrödinger solution. So there was a lot of work done in this series of papers. One of the nice things that was discovered is that the phase diagram is interesting in fact of these two control parameters, the temperature and the chemical potential. You have sort of a transition, you have two regimes. You have this sort of regime where phi is small enough and you almost have a Schwarzschild black hole. Okay. And this maintains the features of the Schwarzschild black hole. In particular, there is a Hawking phase transition for some critical temperatures. So this is the case that we go up here. There is a Hawking phase temperature between the thermal ABS and a non-extremal black hole. But this feature disappears as you go far enough from being a neutral black hole. And at some critical value of this parameter phi, the Hawking phase transition disappears. Okay? And this is interesting because we also find two regimes, as I'll talk about later. There is the near extremal regime, there is the near neutral regime, and the qualitative behavior changes dramatically as you change with them.
Yeah. On this graph, there's supposed to be a line where there is a singularity. I mean, you can't have a large chemical potential in zero temperature. There would be a negative singularity.
For a given temperature, there is...
No, zero temperature.
This is not the charge. This is the chemical potential.
Yeah,
so that's what I'm saying.
If you have a chemical, maybe
it's
not. So in this case, nothing is
simple. Well, we have one of the author of this paper here, but as far as I know, it's those black holes that have large phi and some fixed temperature do exist, as far as I can remember from reading the paper. So it's here. Okay, so this is the very, very basic of the mechanics of this black hole. Now, the interesting things about those Strauss black holes is, as opposed to the neutral black hole, is that the causal structure is very different, and they exhibit other behaviors that are related to that causal structure. Now, here there is a sort of a quote from Tom Schechter's book. And basically what happens is a kind of a subtle observer-dependent phenomena. As we try to approach the inner horizon, so I should say this is asymptotically ABS space, so you have these vertical boundaries here. It's eternal black holes, so you have two of them. Those are the outer horizon here, and these are the inner horizon. And the singularity here is time-like. Okay. So this is the unperturbed space-time, this is the horizon of the black hole. And the question is, can you actually cross this horizon and go and probe the singularity? Okay. And you have an observer-dependent statement because of this blue shifting, because of these features of the geometry, as you try to cross the horizon, and you have any arbitrary weak perturbation here, you're going to see this perturbation be indefinitely occupied. Okay? So you expect some sort of trouble, but making this trouble more concrete requires a little bit more work.
Okay.
In particular, this is a T-state, that's an observable dependent state. Okay. So there's a lot of other literature on this subject. So one of the things that one of the nice papers about this is from Israel from 1990. So one of the things that you can do concretely is just look at classical solution of general relativity and add the so-called null perturbations. Those are perturbations that move at the speed of light either incoming this direction or outgoing this direction. So they were characterized by these two vectors, M and N, which are incoming and outgoing. These rows are their densities. And you can look at their effects. You can try to resolve these Einstein-Maxwell equations, classical equations, with this source added. So let's proceed in two stages. First of all, the simplest thing is where the perturbation is chiral, meaning that you have either the incoming or outgoing, but not both. In this case, you can solve the equation exactly. Okay, so you have, for example, I chose to concentrate on the incoming. Okay, and the formula in this transparency is going to be four-dimensional asymptotically flat case, but the generalization to five-dimensional ADS case are simple. So let's work in this Eddington Christensen coordinates. So you have the charge Bayesian solution, which is an exact solution. You just resolve this equation of motion with this additional source in. And the remarkable thing is that for an arbitrary profile of this perturbation, you can specify a rho in, which is sort of tells the profile of this initial value surface. For an arbitrary profile, you can solve those equations. Okay, and that's related to the fact that you have effectively a plane work symmetry. And the solution is simple. You just modify this function that you had before to include this arbitrary z-dependent mass. Okay. And the b dependence of this mass is given in terms of this arbitrary function. In this particular coordinate, you should think about u and v as this heading consistent and coordinates, and r is an implicit function of u and v. So basically, what you have is a plane wave moving in the u direction with an arbitrary profile in the v direction. And you can solve the equations in the fine-tuned case in which you have just one sort of perturbation. Okay. So a lot of the expected features now are fleshed out. So one thing that you get is that you get infinitesimal forces now in the perturbed spacetime. So you can see that if your observer tries to cross this V equal infinity portion of the Cauchy horizon. Let me, that's going to be important, so let's see. V goes to infinity is the right hand side here. There's no problem here at all. All the problems concentrate on this side of the horizon. Okay. If you try to cross that part of the horizon, then you're going to encounter some tidal forces. There's no curvature singularities. But there are infinitesimal forces, and they're kind of exponentially amplified. Okay. In the paper of Paulson and Israel, there is some discussion of the competition between two effects. One of them is this exponential amplification. The other one is that for realistic black holes that are produced by collapse, the perturbations that are generated by this collapse decay according to this so-called Price law and the decay power law. Since the enhancement is exponential, the decay power law, they don't compete with each other. So you still have that effect. In ADS, this is a little bit more subtle because The perturbation will also decay exponentially because basically gravity is massive in some sense. But it was shown by Chan and Mann that this exponent, this coefficient of the exponent, is always smaller than the surface gravity of the inner horizon, which should cause this exponential enhancement. So you expect to have the same features also in ADS. Okay? Now, as I already said, the curvature environments are not divergent, and that's pretty familiar because you have effectively a plane wave symmetry. All the curvature environments are contracted to zero. And in addition, it was shown, at least for this set of perturbations that are in some sense realistic, this singularity is weak. So you have divergent, some component of the Riemann tensor, some tidal forces are divergent, but any finite body will have a finite total perturbation. Okay. So this is the definition of a weak singularity. It's still singular, but it's in some sense weak. Okay. So the questions that are interesting in this context is what happens when you have a cross-flow perturbation. Cross-flow perturbation simply means that you don't fine-tune anymore. In addition to sending incoming modes, you also allow for outgoing modes. So it's calculationally a more difficult problem. I should also emphasize this is still not a generic space time. Even if you add these two kind of perturbations, you still have a symmetry. So you cannot, for example, involve cosmic synthesis and claim that you know what happens. Also, since you have some sort of instability classically, the interesting question is what happens semi-classically. If this instability sort of triggers by quantum fluctuations. And of course, from my DSAT point of view, the question is, can we see any sign of that at all in the boundary theory? Okay? So you can think that you could see it because, first of all, it's a large effect, it's an instability. And secondly, it's a generic effect. It really doesn't matter how you perturb the system. In some sense, you perturb it in a small way. It doesn't really matter how you do it. You do that, and you're going to get some effect. So in some sense, because it's generic and large, you might expect to see it. Of course, the problem is that it's hidden behind the event horizon, so you might think that it's subtle. Any questions? Okay. So that brings me to the second part of the introduction, which is this issue of probing thermal space-time and those two-sided correlations. So as I said, the obstacle to get this feature of the geometry in the boundary theory, or any feature of any geometry that has a black hole, is that you have to look behind the horizon. And the nice thing about this new probe of thermal space-time is that it's expected to see behind the horizon classically without any subtleties. So let me talk a little bit about that. Let me start with the boundary description of those correlators. And the boundary is some thermal field theory. And in thermal field theory, at finite temperature, the things that you can calculate are observable are some correlation function in which instead of taking them in the vacuum, you just take a thermal average of that over all the states n of the Hamiltonian. Okay? So this is just the Boltzmann average. And there's a well-known way of translating that expression into a path integral where you integrate over, let's call that for example a boson, you integrate over all those insertions and you average by with the action as usual. And the only way that this comes about is by imposing particular boundary conditions on new fields, or in other words, you sum over a particular path, all the paths that obey this boundary condition. This plus sign is 4 boson, this minus 4 fermion, and that has to do with the differences. Okay? So this is where very well known. Now if you think about T Now, since you import some periodicity in the imaginary direction, you're really forced to talk about T as a complex variable. If you think about that as a Lorentzian part, plus some Euclidean part, and implicit only quantities that are zero Lorentzian time, in other words, some static quantities, then you can effectively just rotate that. Instead of talking about Lorentzian, you talk about I times Euclidean time. This brings the usual, more well-known way of thinking about those thermal correlators as some Euclidean function problem, in which you rotate the time, instead of being the Lorentzian time, you rotate it to be Euclidean. Okay. And the final temperature is manifest in the fact that you have this periodicity condition in the Euclidean direction. I have to emphasize here that this is true, this is useful only if you impose T Lorentzian equals zero. More generally, if you're interested in other things, then you will really have to complexify time. So this gives you the Matsuara formalism and the more familiar way of calculating static properties. But final temperature filter is a little bit more subtle. There are more interesting things that you might want to calculate, things that are time dependent, meaning that they have some dependence on Lorentzian time. Okay. So for that, you'll have to choose an integration contour over time, which is treated like a complex variable, which is has to satisfy these two requirements. Okay. So first of all, you have this periodicity, one periodicity for boson and fermions, which is just a shift in the Euclidean time. So this is the only thing that's required for that to be interpreted in the Boltzmann sum. And also, now that you have to have some dependence on Lorentzian time, you have to have insertions on particular points on the Lorentzian time axis. So you better be the case that you contour paths through these points, so you can make those insertions. So one popular choice is this particular contour that go over all the real time from minus infinity to infinity, thereby allowing you to calculate any time-dependent property. But then you have to go all the way down here, eventually, to minus infinity plus I beta. And the way to do that is to jump down by I beta over 2, go back, and then go down again. Okay? It's completely arbitrary how we do that, but this apparently gives some convenient formulas. Now, there's also a Hamiltonian description of this particular prescription, this particular description where this is a jump by half a period. In that prescription, you invent a double of your Hilbert space. So you start with a Hilbert space that tells you about time evolution along this real axis here. But in some sense, you need another Hilbert space to tell you about how your time evolves in this additional time direction, time segment. So in some sense, you double your Hilbert space. You include another Hilbert space in which time runs in the other direction. So this is the so-called thermal double. And then you state that you're talking about in that double Hilbert space is this particular entangled space. Okay, with this kind of square root of the Boltzmann factor. Okay. So in this double case, in this double thermal field theory, you have one set of degrees of freedom living on this line, but you have another set that lives on the other line. Now, if your insertions are limited to these lines alone, you can sort of average over that, and you're going to get the Boltzmann. You're going to get the Boltzmann sum again. So that's the basic idea. And by and large, in all the discussion of thermal field theory, you are indeed only interested in insertions here. Those are the time-dependent thermal quantities. This other segment is just fictitious. Okay. Any questions? Okay. Nevertheless, even though they're fictitious, they're observable if you gauge theory. Okay, so you can calculate them. Okay. And they're related in some sense by analytic configuration. If you know those usual time dependent observable as a function of Lorentzian time, then you can analytically continue and get this new set of observable by shifting some of your observer, some of your operator insertion by half a period here in the imaginary direction. You can certainly do that. And it turns out that even though in field theory those are kind of strange things, in the context of ABS-CFT, these are a nice form of inside the horizon, and therefore they're interesting things to look at. Okay, this goes back to Charlie Israel, and it was revised a few years back by Juan Malas. Okay. So the question is now, you have the prescription of how to calculate those things in the boundary theory. What are those things involved? Okay. And in the bulk, this thermal ensemble is dual to an internal black hole. And the internal black hole has two boundary components. And basically, very naturally, you identify those as the original field theory that you're interested in. And this is in very precise sense the thermal double of it. And if you're interested in calculating correlation function in which you have insertions on both line segments as I drew before, then you put some insertions on this boundary, but you're free to put some insertion on that boundary as well. Okay. Now since those are space-like separated, in some sense they're probe inside this region too, that is inside the horizon. So that's basically the reason why this is an interesting thing to calculate. Okay. Now this can be made much more precisely. Now it turns out that in this, the usual treatment of the complexified portion of space-time, in which you have these four regions, the portion time goes to infinity at the horizons. So you basically have four line segments of the Schwarzschild time, the original one here, it runs sideways here, it runs backwards here, and it runs sideways again. So the contour that this corresponds to in the field theory is somewhat more complicated than the one that traditionally is used. It has four line segments, which are connected by jumps by quarter period rather than half period before. So this is the correspondence between things that they calculate in the bottle and things that they calculate in the boundary. Okay. So you're free, for example, to insert some things here that correspond in the field theory, to put some insertions here, which are the usual correlation functions, but also some insertion on this third line. Okay.
Where does this two go? Can you show the path again on the black hole diagram?
So the path is going to be, as you go around this side, yeah. This is going to be the original Schwarzschild time, which goes here.
Yeah.
And then it diverges at the horizon, which corresponds to this point. You define the jump at the horizon by a quarter period, and then let it run to infinity again this way.
So where is it going? It's going across the top. That first return path, you go out, then you go down, then you go up to the
left.
Where does that left going path go?
Here, it goes backwards. So,
okay.
I'm sorry.
Is it a closed? The whole thing is a closed path?
Well, no.
Or it jumps across from one side?
The whole thing has to be curated by this period, which is the whole thing. So
yeah, but I mean, in the complex plane, you have a closed path. In the space-time diagram,
it's not really closed.
It's just made of discrete segments, one of which is on the right-hand asymptotic region, and one of which is on the left.
Yeah, and you have two additional ones here.
And where are the two additional ones? Where do they come?
Well, you mean in black hole, they're region 2 and 4. It's up to you. For example, if you want to get this path that you had before, that has you can choose other coordinates. Okay, this is just a particular prescription of how to complexify the quantum coordinates that exist outside here, cover the whole extended diagram.
So they're running in a complex space time.
Yeah, they're running it. They generally would run in some congruent or complexified space time that has only this restriction to be periodic here. This is a particular parameterization of this contour in which it's sort of piecewise real. The only time that you move into the complex plane is just in a first horizon. And this is just a matter of choice, but in a simple form.
I think the definition is
yes. Things that depend on them do probe similarity. That's the best
idea. Sort of, suppose you put an insertion on that too. Where would it be? In
yeah, no, I don't know. That's a good question.
Singularity.
Well, yeah, but yes. From the different theory point of view, it does look like the region 3 and region 2 here, those two light segments are very different. But somehow here, they do look different. I don't know what would be the interpretation between the in the gravity side of putting insertions here.
So if you have four copies, then how does it correspond to the Boltzmann ensemble? I mean, I can understand the density matrix can correspond to two copies, because in an entangled state, when you take expectation value in that, that becomes like a standard thermal density matrix.
On the only insertion live on just one side. So this is the usual. So this is not quite true. If you put the insertion in more than one of those sides, then it's no longer corresponding to anything simple in the thermal physical dimension. Because you're really utilizing the fact that you have double.
Right.
If you don't, then you average over the double side and you get the fourth one. Average. Any more questions?
It's still a double, even though you
have
four segments.
Yeah, no, I mean the four segments.
That's the same. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the same question.
It's still the.
There is in this prescription, you might attempt to put insertions on 2 and 4, and I don't know what they were correspond to. Maybe they're correspond to doing something with singularity, but it's not clear after that.
But even choosing this complicated contour, I can still realize it as a single ensemble over entangled states in two physical spaces. You still get a single double, not.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, so those are the correlation functions that are going to be sensitive to the information behind the horizon. So you concentrate, for example, on these two functions that are going to be the most easily computable. So this two-point function is two arguments. One of them is going to live on this left boundary. One of them is going to live on this right boundary. Okay. And as usual in ADS-CFT, the prescription of calculating two-point function is very well known, and it's completely unchanged here. The only thing that changes is that you take this correlation function of two boundary components, but it's completely unchanged. You take the boundary function for these two points, x1 and x2, which are in this case space-like separated, and you have some limiting procedure in which these two points approach the boundary points that you're interested in. Okay? So you need a limiting procedure because things diverge, you need some sort of subtraction, and it's well known that this is dual to the renormalization. If you do the renormalization, you have to do it in the field theory. So this is well understood and completely unchanged here. Okay? So in order to calculate those things, you have to calculate a particular Green's function of a particular field. And the most tricky part here, because because Laplace equations are not easily solvable is to do what the so-called Gibbs problem is mentioned. And this is a very subtle object. Okay? So basically, if you're interested in probe that has very, very high mass, okay? So this is in the dual integral conformal dimension. So for example, you're interested in giant gravitons or anything that has large enough mass, you can have a heat kernel expansion of this green function, the inverse of some propagator, if you have a path integral. This is the first quantization, you sum over all path parameters by this lambda, which is a fine parameter along the path, with this first quantized action, okay, which is just the length squared of that path. And in the semi-classical approximation, in this language, this is where the mass is very large, then you're dominated by subtle points of this path integral, and since those points are space-like separated, you're interested in space-like geometry. Okay. So this is the procedure. So you are left to considering space-like geodesics in your space-time as a probe. Okay, and this is pretty straightforward. So you have a spherically symmetric space-time, so the world line action is as follows. This is just a length square that I said before. This is equal to 1 for space-like geodesics. So you get some equations for the path, T of lambda and R of lambda in the R2 plane. Now, because the space-time is static, you have a conserved energy, which you can use to solve for T. And there you have basically, effectively, a one-dimensional problem of a particle moving in a potential. Okay? So this is R dot, this is dr by the lambda, V of R is minus F of R, this function that appears in this first information space time, and E squared is the conserved energy. Okay? So before doing the calculation, you can just look for qualitative features, and by just looking at this V of R. So for example, for the Schwarzschild case, the qualitative features are as follows. So V of R is monotonic like that. It diverges at R equals 0, which corresponds to the singularity. And the paths are all of the same type. They go up to some turning point here. This turning point is inside the outer horizon. And then they go back. Okay? And that corresponds in the Fengel diagram to the following path. You go from some maximum value of the radial coordinate to some minimum value, which is the turning point here. And then you go back. Okay? So this is the set of paths that you have. Okay? And notice here that if you look at paths that have larger and larger energy, they get closer and closer. The turning point is closer and closer to the singularity that are close to zero. So in effect, the singularity is visible. Okay, so you can discuss qualitative features like that also in the Reisner and Ostrom geometry. So suppose we like to take a neutral particle. So let's talk first about the left side of this diagram. This is a neutral particle without any rotation. So there are two kinds of paths that you can have. In this case, unlike the other case, there is a maximum of the potential. It doesn't go up to infinity. So you can have paths go above that maximum that corresponds to this brown color path that just go from the boundary and just shoot straight to the singularity. Okay? Now, since we're interested in two-sided correlators, those are not going to contribute. We're not really interested in them. And then you have this path that goes below this minimum, the potential. So they go to some turning point. And this turning point is always inside the outer horizon, outside the inner horizon. This is clear from this diagram. So this turning point is always somewhere in the middle between the two horizons. Okay? So this path is going to come here, go to some final distance from the inner horizon, and then to the right direction. Okay? So these are the two things that you have. The situation is slightly more complicated when you have locations, but in the interest of time, I'm going to just skip it. So two things that you can see immediately from this qualitative picture. First of all, you cannot do it into the Cauchy horizon. If you do it into the Cauchy horizon, you will go to singularity, and these two static correlators will never see you. Okay? Only the trajectories that go back to the boundaries are relevant for us. Okay. The other thing that you can see is sort of curious. You never get to actually touch the inner horizon itself. You always accumulate some final distance away from it. Okay, so there's always a minimum distance in which you can probe these new data. Okay, and this will come back later. Any questions? Okay, so now after we understand the qualitative features, we can, yeah.
The last comment you made that you never get inside the inner horizon, is that not just a trivial consequence of the fact that you're looking
at this particular
Sorry?
Yeah, it's a consequence of the type of correlation function you're looking at. Yeah. It's conceivable that some other things will change. It's just certain about those things. So this is not that unexpected. The fact that they accumulate away from the inner horizon is somewhat of a surprise. Okay, so now you can calculate. And the calculation is subtle, but one of the points that we discovered there is that it's a little bit less subtle in our case than it is in the Schwarzschild case. And generally, you're going to have two types of behaviors when you do this calculation. Let me review first what should be called the complicated case, the behavior that was discovered for the Schwarzschild case. And we find that if we have this near neutral case, we find qualitatively similar features. Okay. So how do we do this calculation? Now you look at this correlation function, and it's dominated by saddle points, so it's e to the minus some length, where this length is the length of the shortest geodesic connecting these two boundary points. Okay? And in that particular case, where the space-time static, things can depend only on the sum and not on the difference of these two boundary times. Now, unfortunately, this is a boundary value problem. You're looking for geodesics that connect two particular points. And the first step that you have to do is trade this boundary value for the energy, the conserved energy of the path. Now this is a technical point, but it's an important one because this is the one that leads to all the subtleties. So first of all, as we'll see, this is not the one-to-one correspondence, which leads to a lot of subtleties in that particular case. Secondly, when we're interested in the perturbed space-time, there is no conserved energy. So it would be nice to find a simpler procedure. So let me briefly talk about the subtleties that you encounter in the Schwarzschild case or in the near Schwarzschild case. So what you have is the following. You want to trade this boundary time for this conserved energy that characterizes the geodesics. And there is more than one geodesics. So you have to decide which one dominates. And generally, you have here a steepest descent. I refer to it as a subtle point, but it's really a complex problem. So you have a steepest descent method here. So in steepest descent method, you don't compare the length or the action of different subtle points. You just check which one of them is on the steepest descent path. Okay. So here it would be a steepest descent path in field space, and it's not clear what this path is. Okay. Now, in addition, if you assume that this this patent was it's dominated by the fact that you calculate the behavior of the ratio digits, then you get contradiction communication, for example. Okay? So in the usual case, this multivalued nature of this correspondence was used to hide the signature of the singularity. Okay? So there was some signature of the singularity. This signature did not make sense from the Gauss theory viewpoint, and that was hidden by the fact that this signals some branch out as a function of complexity. Okay, so I'm not going to elaborate too much about that. I just want to say that in our case, we discovered that for the near extremal case, these problems go away. So life is simpler for us. And it's simpler for us because lots of the features of the Schwarzschild case go away if you go far enough in it. So when you calculate boundary time as a function of energy, you just look at this integral and you equate that to the this is a equation that defines for you how you trade this T left plus T right to this energy. Okay. So you can calculate that numerically, this integral, and you can see that as you move the black hole parameters to be far from the Schwarzschild case, this is the feature that you're going to get. There's no multivalued value, and this substitution is okay. You substitute one parameter, the parameters of the path, namely those T left plus T right. You substitute it for another parameter that parameterizes the same space of path, namely E, and this substitution is just one to one, there's no problem. So there's no competing shadows. Okay? And if you look at more elaborate things like the Euclidean section for those who read that paper, this is also the case that this substitution is always one to one. So there's no case of competing geodesics in that case, which is a nice feature. Okay? So the situation is a little bit more, a little bit less subtle. Okay? The other thing that's evident from this graph is that T of E diverges as E squared goes to the maximum of this potential, and this is something that you expect, because all paths that have E bigger than this V max just shoot into the singularity. It turns out that they're irrelevant for another reason, because T just already went to infinity as you vary T squared from 0 to V max. So the physical region of energy is between 0 and the maximum of extension. Okay? So some of this calculation is a little bit less subtle, and this is a nice thing. So you can calculate those the length of the geodesics and therefore the correlation function as a function of E. Okay, this is pretty straightforward. We need to plot it in this physical region. And again, we find that, as expected, this diverges at very large values, which is the usual renormalization. So you have to do some subtraction, basically subtract off some contribution from infinity, which is universal. It's just a contribution that you get in ADS as well. And what you get is the following. You get that L of E diverges as you go from E squared from 0 to V max. This is the physical region. So you go to V max, T goes to infinity. Okay. So since the length is proportional to T there, you get basically that the correlation function exponentially decays at large times, which is a sensible thing that you might expect. Okay. And as I said before, the set of relevant geodesics accumulated some final distance away from the issue horizon. Any questions?
So this is a prediction from the bulk side. I mean, is there? So you're going to calculate that two-point correlation function?
In the boundary theory?
Yeah.
At large something. No, this is just prediction from This is just a prediction from the. Yes. But one point that I can make is that this is a sensible behavior. Unlike the behavior that you discover, for example, when you calculate simple actions in a swap case, this is something sensible from the gauge theory point of view. So this is not the quality of the behavior would not surprise.
So, do you exactly put on operating systems in this case?
Well, we've been this, but you may get it.
So what does this correlation function tell us about the singularity?
There's no singularity here. One of the reasons. One of the reasons why this behaves nicely is that there is no singularity.
So how do you. But there is a singularity, right? There is still this region 2 and 4, right?
There's no singularities there. You region 2 and 4 are the regions between the outer and the inner horizon. Okay? And the inner horizon is an unstable. Once you start perturbing units, there is some phenomena that's going to happen there.
You basically showed that there are no.
So this is, if you want, this is this is just probing space time, which is not very discrete. In some sense, the unperturbed Russian black hole probed by these probes does not show any features that are, you don't have large curvatures anymore, nothing particularly drastic happens, and therefore you get a normal gauge theory behavior.
Is it special for you that you look at the DA extreme model, I guess.
Well, the Schwarzschild.
I'd like to see how you. What changes when you go from Schwarzschild and you get, I guess, a small chart.
Two things happen in the Schwarzschild case. One of them is that the results that you naively extract from the gravity side does not make sense in case you're language. And secondly, that you have some sort of range cuts that you have to go through to relate between the two pictures. Those two things are not necessarily related to each other. They both happen in the Schwarzschild case. But I'm not really sure that this is a general statement. Okay. As you perturb away from Schwarzschild, then it seems like the two behaviors sort of disappear more or less around the same time. I'm not sure I'm answering the question.
I guess your idea was to look at the singularity.
No. My idea is, first of all, look at what we need to be able to decode those things. So I want to look at the unperturbed case, now I want to perturb it and see how those things change. And I want to perturb it eventually at the point where the change is radical and see what would be the signature effect. I think if you just look at the singularity, as you did in the Schwarzschild case, you've got some mess, you don't really know how to compare it from the normal to it. So this is one of the reasons for doing it. By the way, I'm already over time. Okay, I'll try and keep it longer. Okay, so this was the features of the Russian Norton black hole without any perturbation. And as I said, it exhibits a behavior that is normal from the gauge theory point of view. You have a correlation function which decays exponentially at late times. So now we can start playing with more interesting space time. For example, we can turn on perturbations that are localized behind the horizon and see if we can see them in the gauge theory language and see if we can decode them. Okay? So the third problem for that, eventually I'll be interested in perturbation which destabilizes space-time. So the third problem is to add perturbations as drawn coming in from the left boundary. Okay? And these have the features that, first of all, the effect is purely localized behind the horizon. It does go between here and here. And it can be arbitrarily localized. since I can solve the equations for any profile of these perturbations, this could be as localized as I want. So I have some way of perturbing the space-time in localized way, which is purely behind the horizon. And I want to see how the gauge theory, in particular those correlation functions we're interested in, how those how do those correlation functions see that perturbation. Okay. So in particular, the simplest thing to do is to take an infinitely thin pulse, just coming here from a single point at time, t sub t, and plot the correlation function as a function of this time. Okay. So basically, before doing that, what is the expected answer, and what can you learn about the gauge theory from it? So as I said, these perturbations are destabilize the space-time in some sense, because once you add this perturbation in, you're going to have large curvatures on this part of the Cauchy universe. Okay, so they still destabilize the space-time. So in some sense, adding them in is not a small perturbation. Okay. And this is something that is not very surprising from a gauge theory point of view. You have some sort of non-analyticity of the observables in the strength parameter of these perturbations. This will be the statement in the gauge theory point. Okay. So, for example, one way in which things like that happen is when you have a breakdown of perturbation theory in this parameter, and you have to resum it. Okay. And after you resum it, you get things that are non-analytic, fractional powers, or log of lambda, or things of that sort. So this is something that happens in thermal field theory. And this is the expected thing that's going to happen here. Sending an arbitrarily small perturbation here, or characterized by this small fractional lambda, will dramatically change the result. Okay. On the other hand, this is a little bit surprising, this sort of qualitative features. As I just wrote, this is come from resummation following some infrared divergences. This is a field theory, it's a finite temperature, it's a finite chemical potential. It's on finite space, a sphere. So why would you have any infrared divergence? And the only possible reason you can have infrared divergence here is that you have large energy effects. We're working on infinite energy. Okay? So this is sort of a nice picture. As soon as you put n to be finite, you don't have any source for divergences at all, and therefore you don't have any source for non-analyticity at all. So you're sort of guaranteed for this problem, this possible problem, to go away as soon as you turn on finite n. Okay? Questions?
What's n? What's
n? N is the rank of the gate group, which is in some sense, the syntax. So, and infinite n is working at string 3 level.
So, you're saying that you're expecting the string theory to regularize, to remove the divergence in the space time?
Yeah, but I will see later that these observables do not exceed this problem. Okay? But if you had a problem, then the only source of regularizing it would be string effects. So for example, alpha prime effects are guaranteed not to solve the problem in this case, just based on general principles.
So was another question? Maybe higher order curvature. On the gravity side, you would add higher order curvature terms on how regulate the behavior of the perturbations in the horizon?
Well, no, it's what? I don't expect any sort of finite number of parameter terms to solve it. And again, very surprisingly, maybe those correlation functions do not exhibit any such behavior as I have seen from the next transparency. But if you hook up something that has that sees the dramatic effect of this perturbation, this I think would be its gauge theory interpretation. So this doesn't happen, as I said, for the correlation function we're interested in. The perturbation theory lambda does not break down. And I'm going to skip the detail of your calculation, but basically the reason is that when you turn on this perturbation, you do get some large curvatures somewhere, at least large tidal forces. But as I said before, these correlation functions are dominated by space-like geodesics that never approach the Cauchy horizon. So there's always some finite distance away from it. Even though there are large curvatures here, the curvature of this correlation, that this geodesic see, is always bounded. Okay? So there is some sort of geometrical mechanism here to avoid seeing this particular problem. And again, this is a little bit more complicated because once you perturb the space-time, the causal structure changes a little bit, but the statement is still correct. The space-like geodesics never really reach the region of large curvatures. You always have bounded curvature here.
So in your computing correlation function, in the sense that you find the dominant geodesic and just say
right.
correlation is exponential, this geodesic.
Right.
Like 7-point geodesic.
Yeah.
So maybe, maybe there are some subtleties with this.
There are subtleties, but I think for the near extreme cases, the subtleties, as far as I know, are a little bit close. There's always subtleties. But the question that you didn't ask, if my work way to calculate something else or use a different approximation, you do see the effects.
It's just that I don't know whether it's that you're just really a dominant contribution.
If you're just unique, I'm sort of wrong. Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Still more questions.
Well, it was the same question, basically. Because you're just doing some approximation, some settle point approximation by using this geodesic. So if there's actually infinite sort of divergent contributions somewhere else, maybe you just don't see them expanding about the settle point.
Yeah. So the reason geodesic said that it's not only a settle, but that falls in a sense close to a singularity.
Just a curve.
It's still contributing to a correlation function.
No, okay,
be a signature
as long as the curvature is seen by this geodesic is bounded, you can make it arbitrarily small.
That's true. If you look at the geodesics, but in a correlation function, in a sense, you capture some of all passes that are not.
And you're doing this as an introduction to a heat kernel.
Right.
Is that really a path integral overall?
Right. So it's not the
system without changing.
I'm not sure that that's still the way I was thinking.
This is an odd question. This is an odd. Suppose I calculate, for example, a correlation function, which I don't mean by geodesics, very, very far away from singularity. I think the existence of singularity somewhere else in space could necessarily affect it.
I don't know. And I'm not sure whether the geodesic approximation is well.
You can ask the same question in Schwarzschild black hole. Suppose you're interested in two observations outside the horizon. You think the existence of singularity is important for them?
Well, I mean, there's subtleties that you pointed out. You're really doing some deformation of a complex contour. You have to reach the saddle point. Is there actually some consistency? Is there really a steepest descent? Yeah.
That's right.
Could it hit some sort of singularity, maybe do some strange topography?
That's right.
Prevent you from deforming to the steepest descent.
Yeah, the only thing I can say is that we look for such subtleties and we didn't find them.
Are there well-defined rules for how we're the steepest, for identifying the steepest descent path?
Yeah, I guess maybe just playing this is some simple game with just integrals. You have an integral which has a singularity, and the simple point is well defined in that integral. It's not, the question I think we're asking is not really about the geodesics, which in your space are much better shaped than normal. It's like the summing of all these things, even though each of them, it's a press.
Okay. At least this contribution to the path integral gives you something that is under control and didn't have to be under control. Might be something else separate. in fact. Okay, so I'm going to skip the details of the calculations. And let me just conclude. And the conclusion is that eventually we want to look at the next step, the more interesting phase time. So the first thing that we need to do is find better correlation functions. Those correlation functions that we talked about need to boundary value problems to be revisited. You fix point on this side, you fix a point on this side, you look for the buildings that connect both points. It would be nice to find something like an initial value problem that would be, first of all, will solve the problem with the non-uniqueness, as you did this, that we have talked about before. It's also just easier to calculate once you preserve the space time and you don't have to consider anything. And the next thing to do is really talk about the slow space time. And those lead to a real instability to this. Phenomena of mass inflation, and I'm not going to talk about that at all. It's some very, very good. Okay, so let me stop here.
So, do we have some more questions?
I was confused about some very basic issues. I think it has nothing to do with this specific calculation, but you were computing correlators between two boundaries on the right-hand side, is that right?
Yes.
And you were claiming that they blew up until you renormalized them, they actually blew up.
Yeah.
That just seems, is that from the vault point of view, is that a natural expectation? I mean, why would you expect
well,
you're going up.
There is contribution just in pure ideas, there are going to be a contribution because the boundaries are extremely far away. So you have to renormalize it.
But why does it?
So
you're just saying somehow it's a local divergence at the boundary. It's not that the.
Oh, no. It's a divergence of large distances. It's the divergence near the boundary.
It's a short distance.